Internet thing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All right, everyone. I'm going to open a public hearing. Wait a second. No, I'm not. I'm going to say today is March 19th, 2015, and this is a subcommittee on public safety of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I will then open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5504, the Department of Corrections budget.
We have many, many people who wish to speak today, so I have my three-minute timer. If people could confine their remarks to 3 minutes, that would be the best and greatest thing in the world. Overflow is in the East Galleria. There's a TV screen there. Unfortunately, we don't have a room for overflow. But Madam Chair will call out who's on deck, and people who are watching in the Galleria can hear that and make their way to H174. Responses to yesterday's questions are posted on OLIS under yesterday's date, and that's all I have.
All
those
right.
Those three need to be together, so maybe these three.
Okay, well, we'll start there.
Okay.
Get them. All right, so we're going to start with Commissioner Bernard, Chris Hoy, and Dr. Bernard. And then on deck we'll do Mindy Clark and Jen Netherwood. Do you want me to do three at a time?
Yeah, we've got three chairs.
So okay, and then we'll also bring up, why don't we bring up Doug Cooper from Mercy Corps?
You're first.
Okay. Great. Hi.
Hi, Chair Williamson and members of the committee. I'm Clackamas County Commissioner Jim Bernard. I'm the senior commissioner and vice chair. I also serve as a co-chair of AOC's Public Safety Committee, Community Corrections Commission, and represented counties on the Justice Reinvestment Grant Committee. Obviously, public safety has been one of my priorities since I was elected in 2009. The DOC has continued to have a strong relationship with counties in order to provide the best outcome for taxpayer dollars. Support of our community corrections programs have a proven success record and have reduced recidivism and curbed our demand on the prison system. Clackamas County's investment of HB 3194 funds in transitional beds, drug treatment programs have proven to be successful. Captain Chris Hoy, Clackamas County's Community Corrections Director and President of the Association of Community Corrections Directors, will highlight our efforts. He's right here. The collaborative effort between the counties and DOC has led to increased information sharing, combined training and support, and a multiple public safety summits around the state. We support funding for the department's electronic healthcare records and new offenders inmate computer system to make operations more efficient and effective, saving all of us taxpayer dollars. We also support funding for the Justice Reinvestment Grant Committee as promised and in the governor's budget at $58.5 million in order for counties to continue their successful programs like the ones we have in Clackamas County. We support full funding of the grant and of DOC's budget and do not believe that we should cut either program. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, my name is Chris Hoy. I'm the Community Corrections Director in Clackamas County, and I'm the President of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. I've submitted written testimony, so I won't go through all of that, but I did want to highlight just a few things. Community Corrections is a full partner in Senate Bill 1145 that was passed 20 years ago that sent local control to the communities, and we have worked very closely with the Department of Corrections for the past 20 years to make that work. This baseline funding that's outlined in the co-chair's framework fully funds us. The governor's budget does not. We support full funding because we don't think that opt-out is a wise strategy for Oregon. We also support full funding of the justice reinvestment dollars because the baseline funding is really the backbone, and justice reinvestment really gives us the opportunity to take it to the next level, and they really work in partnership together. We would really encourage you to support both of those. Some of the examples that you've heard from me before and some of my clients, but I just wanted to highlight a few things that Community Corrections has done with our grant and aid and with some of the $3194 dollars. We have, through an expanded short-term transitional leave program, we have saved numerous prison bed days, and I believe it's over 35,000 bed days that have been saved those offenders have been supervised within our communities, eliminating the need to open prison beds and eliminating the need to build new prisons. And that's just a wise investment, and we would encourage you to fund this to continue with that. In Yamhill County, they have an evidence-based decision-making model where community justice partners came together and developed an early defendant analysis program, and that's resulted in 485 prison months saved alone just from Yamhill County. 243 fewer people have gone to prison. In Marion County, they have a demonstration project that's a prison diversion program. It provides accountability and treatment and supervision through wraparound services. 85 people have been placed in that program, and their 18-month recidivism rate is 11.3 compared to 19% for other probationers in Marion County. In Clackamas County, we invested in short-term transitional leave beds, which is and transitional housing, which is critical for offenders to get when they're getting out of prison. Every person coming out of prison who comes to Clackamas County is guaranteed a place to live for the first 90 days. I'm very proud of that fact, and I think it's those first 90 days are so critical in a successful transition. And we also assign a mentor to them, and we've also expanded their alcohol and drug treatment program with those dollars. In Deschutes County, they've increased their short-term transitional leave supervision. In Jefferson County, they have developed a gender and culturally responsive groups for incarcerated individuals. In Tillamook County, they restarted a GED program. In Hood River County, they developed a dual diagnosis contract with a treatment provider. Also, I wanted to mention, in Clackamas County, we also provide the Parenting Inside Out program. Wrap it up. I got the wrap it up sign. I am wrapping it up. The one thing I wanted to mention, the thing that this does not do, it does not provide misdemeanor supervision, which means, for the most part, domestic violence offenders are not paid for by this grant. Those are we just sort of thin the soup to make that happen, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention that today. I will wrap it up.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Shields and Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Kimberly Bernard, no relation, and I manage the largest research team in county community corrections, and on behalf of Multnomah County and OACCD, I'm here to draw your attention to policy option package 104 in the Department of Corrections budget. That proposal is what's going to begin the long and overdue process of replacing the current corrections information system, otherwise known as CIS and sometimes referred to as DOC 400. CIS is the system of record for community corrections and state institutions. It's the foundation for how we collect information for operational decisions, policy formation, mandatory reporting, QA, release of information to the public. It's a critical, critical system. This system was created using a programming language that began in the early 1960s. It's a dying language. It's the programming equivalent of Latin, and there's not too many members that speak it anymore. But it also holds us back in being able to take advantage of technology advances and to keep pace with evidence-based practices. We really want a nimble and efficient community supervision system. We want our officers to be able to use their cell phones and type progress notes while they're out in the community on a home visit. We want them to be able to send text messages to offenders. We want them to be able to share critical information with local nonprofits in a central, secure, web-based system. All of that is technologically possible right now, but the barrier is our CIS system. I'm going to assume that not too many people in the room have had the opportunity to navigate CIS. I'm just going to briefly describe what you would experience right from the beginning. You'll notice that there's no way to navigate with a mouse in CIS because CIS predates mouse navigation. There's no web browser view. There's no field to enter an email address for the offender because the system predates email by 30 years. And we do not have the ability to send or receive emails with offenders through CIS. Likewise, there's no field for mobile phones. And there's no data field for an outside treatment provider or a court-ordered service to put progress notes into CIS. The process right now is for them to type up the notes and they mail or fax it to an officer who then has to retype it into CIS. So there's lots of inefficiencies, and I think you get the impression that it's an outdated system. So the funding in Proposal 104 will allow DOC to begin the development of a data system that will help us keep pace with innovation and evidence-based practices. There's a lot that has changed in community corrections in the last 30 years. It will replace silos and allow for more efficient information sharing, which is critical to success. It will enhance supervision, and it will provide easy access to data and better measurements and outcomes, which is important to me as a researcher. So thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
I know what you're going to say, Representative Krieger.
I'm not going to say a word about that.
It's the only system he would be able to navigate.
Well, the story is, if it doesn't have a trigger or a fishing reel handle, I ain't interested.
You've been together too much.
No, we spend too much time together.
Just a comment, maybe. I think, Chris, you were in the committee when we were having testimony on House Bill 3194.
Yes.
And I was more impressed with that, what Clackamas County is doing. Mm-hmm. If we all could do that, we wouldn't be worrying about 14,000 or 15,000 in the state facility. We'd be down around 10 or 11.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mindy Clark, Jen Netherwood, and Doug Cooper. And on deck, we have Nancy Campbell.
That's a word.
Jeff Hernandez.
6 months.
And then, Mary, do you want to introduce your Ask Me folks? So why don't you come up on this panel?
On this one?
Yep. And you can go last, because the next set of folks are all your people.
Okay.
So you're on deck.
My girlfriend got the phone, and it was one of these. Thank you.
Whichever order you'd like, just your name for the record.
And members of the committee, my name is Mindy Clark. I'm here on behalf of Pathfinders of Oregon. We do programming inside the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to speak specifically to the Parenting Inside Out program. 20,000 Oregon children have an incarcerated parent, and recent research has shown that having an incarcerated parent has worse short and long-term outcomes for children than having parents divorce or losing a parent to death. Parenting Inside Out is a program that's offered in the Department of Corrections. It was a joint project of the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Social Learning Center, and Pathfinders of Oregon, that grew out of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, which was a statewide effort started in the early 2000s. Oregon was one of the first states, along with New York, to address the issues and concerns of children of incarcerated parents, and is the only state to invest in developing programming to meet those needs. The content of Parenting Inside Out was developed by the Oregon Social Learning Center and is based on its best practices program parent management training that appears on the best practices lists of the Department of Justice, the Department of Health and Human Services, and the American Psychological Association, and was developed specifically for high-risk children and families. To that best practices core, Parenting Inside Out adds lessons, techniques, tools that are specific to parenting from within a prison or parenting as a criminal justice-involved parent. PIO is culturally responsive, trauma-informed, and addresses 3 of the 6 criminogenic risk factors. It is 108 hours in length, 90 hours in the classroom, and 18 hours of homework. Originally, there was a second phase of the program that was coached parenting visitation. That part of the program has yet to be funded. PIO was the subject of a $2.1 million grant funded by the National Institutes of Mental Health to measure its effectiveness. In 2013, we received notification from SAMHSA that they had reviewed the study and reviewed the results and that PIO had been added to the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices, NREP. In addition, it's been reviewed by the Federal Bureau of Prisons and appears on its model programs list. Since regular classes began in 2004, more than 5,000 Oregon parents have been through the program, including more than 1,500 women. In the most recent biennium, the cost per parent was $715. And yet, there's a waiting list for this program in almost every institution. PIO is part of the larger DOC program to be more family-friendly in visitation. Extended family visits, which are now common in most Oregon institutions, actually grew out of Parenting Inside Out graduation celebrations. There's also a community-based version of Parenting Inside Out, and we provide training to agencies and nonprofits across the state, including Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, Marion County, Lane County, Klamath County, Lake County, Malheur County, Columbia County, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla, and the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. PIO is a nationally recognized program that is in use in the Kansas Department of Corrections, the Massachusetts Department of Corrections, and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. It is also the primary choice of many municipalities across the country who have received Second Chance Act funding.
Ms. Clark, can you wrap it up?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry, I have to be the bad
That's
guy.
That's okay. That's okay. This is simply the best and most effective parenting program that is available for parents in this population. As the committee considers the DOC budget, I ask that you consider additional funding for Parenting Inside Out so that every parent who wants the class can take it and so that we can provide the coached parenting time that was in the original model. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williamson and Co-Chair Shields and committee members. For the record, my name is Jen Netherwood, and I am an educational volunteer for Portland Community College at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I'm new to this. I've never testified before, so please bear with me if I'm
a bit nervous.
I'm here today to talk to you about a project that I've been working on for the past year and a half for Coffee Creek. Little bit of history. I was employed by Oregon Corrections Enterprises as a vocational instructor from October 2012 to August 2013, and I taught a BOLI-certified pre-apprenticeship program at the institution. We had 40 women successfully complete the program in that time. The most amazing thing to me that I saw happen was the change in the women, the sense of pride that grew as they learned how to use a skill saw and a table saw. None of them lost any fingers or had any accidents. They started to tell me stories about phone conversations that they had with their kids, and their kids were amazed that their mom could use a table saw and build a sawhorse and build a small house and wire it and roof it. I worked with apprenticeship coordinators from several different trade unions. I am a union carpenter myself. And when I was hired to teach the program, I had never been inside a prison before. My interview was simply, can you pass a background check, and have you ever been inside a prison? And I answered yes and no. And I, too, went through a change after being inside the prison and learned that I have a passion for doing this kind of work, and I would like to continue to do this kind of work and bring this program to the women at Coffee Creek. OCE decided to cancel the program because it wasn't profitable. And since August of 2013, I've been working as a volunteer with Portland Community College to build a brand new program, one that would be under an education umbrella rather than OCE's umbrella. And we've already been approved by the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council. The new program would be 1,000 hours and would go well beyond just teaching them how to use a table saw and a speed square and a hammer. We would include things like overcoming barriers. I would work with reentry programs and union apprenticeship coordinators. So my vision of this program goes well beyond the walls at Coffee Creek. I feel that this program truly gives inmates a path to a family wage career. And the construction industry at this point is hungry for including more women and minorities in the workforce. And this program, I feel, could absolutely contribute to that. And I'm asking today for you to consider funding for this program, and I sincerely appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thank you for all of your volunteer work. That's fantastic.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Doug.
Good afternoon. Many members, thank you for having us this afternoon. My name is Doug Cooper. I'm the Assistant Director at Mercy Corps Northwest. And I'm here today because of several projects that we run in collaboration with DOC, primarily at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. In 2006 and 2007, we designed and started to teach a class in entrepreneurship and self-business ownership for the women at Coffee Creek. it's a 32-week class. It's very rigorous. They learn very hardcore business skills. There's an incorporation of a lot of life skills and soft skills that are very clear corollaries in life, to be a good spouse, to be a good community member, to be a good employee. The class is taught by our staff and by community volunteers. We have two or three of our staff that rotate in regularly. We teach in teams. We have a woman from Nike that comes in regularly. Carolyn McKnight, who started the social entrepreneurship program at Portland State, is teaching with us. We have about 200 women to date that have graduated from the program. And in 2013, we had an evaluation from DOC, our preliminary evaluation, and it showed good results. We had a 41% reduction in recidivism. That's a little bit under statistical significance, but they ran it through several different models and didn't expect that to change over time. We've also been involved in collaboration between DOC, the Oregon Health Department, and Multnomah County Health Department to improve health outcomes at Coffee Creek. And this actually came out of the entrepreneurship class because part of the we'd received a Robert Wood Johnson grant to incorporate chronic disease self-management information into our curriculum. And part of that was around healthy eating. And when our partners from the health departments came in and started polling the women, they were getting a little over 3,000 calories a day, which was way beyond recommended levels, especially with the level of activity. So they put together a grant that was funded by Kaiser Community Health Foundation, and that grant resulted in more gender-appropriate menus. I don't know if you've seen the interior of Coffee Creek, but instead of being a grass area that dries up in the summer, it's now all garden. And it's maintained by inmate teams. We included health and diet education. All of the menus are now labeled with health information, including calories. And we also helped make changes for more healthy choices in the canteen choices. So I'm here today to advocate for continued funding of strong programming within the DOC. We're actually not funded by DOC. We brought all of our own funding to the project. But we know the impact that our programs and programs like us that you're hearing from have on the women, and it really is incredibly important for them for their continued success. And we'd also like to commend DOC for their willingness to work with community-based organizations. We've found them as being incredibly good partners, and especially when we talk with colleagues from other places around the country, it's not always true of Department of Corrections. So we really appreciate their cooperation and their willingness to work with us in the work that we do. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So Nancy Campbell, Jeff Hernandez, and Mary Bodkin. And then the next two panels will be AFSCME folks on deck.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Williamson, Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing our hearing our testimony. Thank you for your time. My name is Jeffrey Hernandez. I'm a sergeant at Oregon State Penitentiary. I worked for the Department of Corrections for 10 years in minimum at Columbia River, medium security at Oregon State Correctional Institution, and maximum security at Oregon State Penitentiary in essentially every working area that we have, including our mental health infirmaries. I also taught at Department of Public Safety Standards and Training for 4 years as a part-time corrections instructor, and I study law enforcement and human and gender studies at New York University. This is the background that I'm bringing in for my testimony today. I'm an executive board member for the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and we are urging your support for this bill for the funding. For the last few years, we've worked under the budget constraints, and we try to do more with less. Our staff members have stepped up admirably in this recession time to make ends meet and meet the needs of the department. And the department itself has come back to us and asked us to do more and given us as much resources, as much support as they possibly can. This has informed wellness programs in their staffing requirements and their training programs. Now we're asking for a little bit more too, so we can build this up. Part of our issue is that with more staff and more budgeting, we can provide more one-on-one time for the inmates. This is especially important when we're working with a greater mentally ill inmate population. We can provide a greater one-on-one staff ratio that alleviates some of these problems early. We also have a staffing relief factor with more positions available and more staff members to provide vacation relief, sick time relief. We see overtime costs dropping. We see stress and wellness levels, our stress levels dropping and wellness levels rising in our staff that create a healthier workforce and creates less tension and more safety and security within inside our institutions. We also see a lessening of mandatory overtime shifts, which also lowers our medical costs over the long term as staff are able to have more downtime and able to spend more time with their families, loved ones, things along that times. Furthermore, with more staffing, more budgeting, we're providing more jobs for Oregonians, particularly returning veterans that are looking for a living wage that can support their families completely. And then finally, there's a policy option package that the Department of Corrections has that provides 33 more positions for staff relief, for staffing relief factors. This is not covered in the governor's budget or in the co-chair's budget, but it's something that we strongly support. It's something that would increase our wellness levels. It would provide more resources to the department to provide better services and better customer service for our adults in custody and provide a greater client response as we look at better and better ways of meeting our population. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Should I go next?
Okay. Yep.
Co-chairs Williamson and Shields and committee members. I'm Nancy Campbell. I'm here with wearing two hats, and I'm here in support of the Family Preservation Project at Coffee Creek. Excuse me, I have allergy problems that affect my throat. I'm a retired circuit court judge from Washington County. I went on the bench in 1988. So I have a lot of experience with the system. I'm also, and I'm here representing the National Organization for Women. I'm on both the National Board and the Oregon Board. Thank you, that may help. How I got involved with this was a petition came across my eyes somehow. And it was written by a graduate of the program. And I read through it and it intrigued me, but I wasn't going to sign it because I'm always a little bit questioned, former inmates. I have had experience of not necessarily being truthful. And I wanted to find out more about it. And there was on the petition somewhere a way to contact the woman who wrote the program. I sent her an email, gave her my phone number, also said I was a retired judge. I thought it was very interesting that she called me back, talked very appropriately, and explained how important this program was to her and what it had done for her. She gave me the name of Jessica Katz, who was the program coordinator. I called her and talked to her. And then I happen to have a friend who's also a retired judge who I knew had done some volunteer work at Coffee Creek. So I talked to her. It turned out she'd actually volunteered with the Family Preservation Project. I talked with her. She spoke extremely highly of it, was very distraught to hear that it was being cut, and also offered to do whatever she could to help. To me, this program is extremely important and should be expanded and not cut. It's cost effective, even though the reason for it's being cut is financial. I think that's not looking at it in the long term. There is a zero recidivism rate with this program. The cost of housing somebody in prison for several years has got to be more than the cost of providing this program to them. I know it is. And it just doesn't make sense to me that it's being stopped. Even more importantly is it focuses on the needs of the kids. Children we know of incarcerated parents have a much higher likelihood of reoffending. This program works on their education, it works on their social skills, and it keeps the bond between the mother and the child, and that is extremely important.
Campbell, actually, your buzzer went off.
Okay.
Your 3 minutes is up.
Okay.
If you want to wrap up really quickly or...
I just want to add one thing, the importance of focusing on the mothers. We know that when a father goes to prison, usually the child will remain with the mother. it's a sad fact, and I wish it were different, but when a mother goes to prison, usually the father is not there to parent. So it's extremely important to focus our needs there. I'd love to see it for everybody, but
I think that's
where the dollars need to be spent.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
You sure can, Senator Winters.
Because
it's under 3 minutes.
It's way beyond 3 minutes. And in your role in the court and looking at how very, very small and slim this program is, I mean, very small numbers, and looking at where, you know, there are certain selection criteria or not, how do you avoid the issue of year in, year out, and how then, and even from a kind of a very technical legal standpoint, how do you rise above what could be if I'm excluded? That I do not have a cause of action because I'm not allowed to be in the particular program.
Well, I'm not in a position to give legal advice for a lot of reasons. One reason, I'm no longer a member of the Oregon State Bar because I'm retired. So I don't want to do that. But I think all of the programs at the prison are limited in who they provide them to. People are chosen to be in that program for one reason or another. There are lots of people that are excluded from particular programs. And this happens, I think, with every program in the prison. I can recommend as a judge that somebody go into a program. I can't order it, but I can recommend it. That doesn't mean they will. They are chosen based on criteria, just as these women are chosen based on certain criteria. I think the program should be expanded to include more anyway, because it is successful.
Thank you. Ms. Botkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mary Botkin, and I'm here today with AFSCME Council 75. And I'm going to do the 30-second thing, and Senator Winters has been calling me out from the dais off and on all week. So I'm going to now return the favor and say, yes, indeed, I still will work to develop with you a program for aging and disabled inmates. Senator Winters and I have been working on this for many sessions. We believe it is critically important that as we look at inmates who are not going to get out for a long time, that we make adjustments within the system to more properly house and facilitate their aging process with an appropriate housing unit, and that we also take a look at developing a good hospice program for inmates who are suffering from final stages of life and have more access to the family members. And, you know, we will continue to work with and hound the director to see that this occurs. I know she feels hounded already by this by both of us, but it is one of the things that the senator and I have identified many years ago, and we continue to believe it's an important role. That's my sort of 1 minute pitch. With me today, we have several corrections officers who were in town for bargaining. And as luck would have it, public testimony for the first time fell at the right time so that they could be here with us today. And they will introduce themselves as they come up. But just so you have a sense of who is here, we have Ryan Jordan from our transport team, Jeff Kaufman from EOCI in Pendleton, Matt Ballard from Columbia River in Portland, Greg Clouser from Two Rivers in Umatilla, and Frank Lewis from Santee Am here in Salem. And with that, I'm going to step away, and hopefully Tim Woolery, who is my colleague and the chief spokesperson for our union, for the Department of Corrections and the head staff person, will be able to sort of walk you through the issues that AFSCME has, both supporting and wanting enhancements in the budget.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Tim, Ryan, and Greg, if you guys want to come on down. And then Matt, Darren, and Frank, you're on deck. And I'll give the next panel after these guys. And so remember to say your name for the record, and 3 minutes you'll hear a beep.
I know it's really expensive. Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Woolery for the record. As Mary stated, I work for Oregon AFSCME. Prior to that, I worked in the Department of Corrections for about 18 years. I provided written testimony so that these gentlemen could have an opportunity to talk, and you don't need to hear from me. I am assuming that I will be talking with each of you in your offices or anytime you have questions and assisting. The only thing I'm going to emphasize besides my written testimony is the interest that we have in the wellness of our staff that work inside these prisons. We want you to support the policy package that was not included in the governor's budget, but we want you to go further than that. The relief factor is outdated and needs to be updated to let these people have some time with their families, and they do a very hard job, and I'll let them speak for themselves.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Jordan. I'm a transport officer. I am the local president for the transport unit for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I've been with the department for 20 years. Currently, the Department of Corrections has 15 facilities across the state of Oregon and houses a little over 14,000 inmates. The transport unit has 65 staff assigned, and we are responsible for transfers, medicals, court appointments, extraditions, body viewings, emergency trips, roll-ups, courtesy moves for the facilities, and any other inmate moving outside the secure facilities. With 65 staff assigned throughout the state, transport averages 586,000 miles per year. We conduct an average of 16,189 inmate transfers per year. We take out an average of 5,738 medicals per year out into the community. Just in 2014 alone, we have used 453 staff that are not assigned to transport to assist in transport duties. Transport also conducts many single escort trips per year into the community. Due to the lack of staff in transport, we have been forced to place many medical trips back onto the facilities to do their own transport. This causes a shortage of staff and a need to hire overtime in the facilities. The average single escort trip can last anywhere from 1 hour to 8 hours. It is the expectation from DOC management that if a staff member needs to use the restroom, they are to leave the inmate unsupervised. An unsupervised inmate causes an unnecessary risk to the community. The inmate has the ability, while unsupervised, to emotionally or physically assault someone in the general public, not to mention the risk of escape. This practice jeopardizes the safety of the general public and goes against the mission of the Department of Corrections. Transport staff recommend all inmates, regardless of custody level, have 2 escort staff to ensure not only the safety of the general public and staff, but will also meet the Oregon Department of Corrections mission. Thank you for your time and support.
Thank you.
Hello.
Co-Chairman Williamson, Shields, and the members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today actually to speak to you. My name is Greg Clouser. I'm a corporal at Two Rivers Correctional Institution and the local president there. I have worked for the department for over 15 years. I moved my family here from Ohio in 2000 because of the great opportunity the state offered for working for DOC. Over the years, I have been through furloughs, step freezes, pay cuts, and insurance issues, but have stayed because of the great people I work with and the safe prisons that we run here in Oregon. I sit here today to tell you about some of the issues that we have at most of our facilities. At Two Rivers, as well as others in this state, we have added many temporary bunks in places not designed for bunks. We make inmates live in places that are not designed for inmates to live in. When TRCI opened in 1999, and at that time the facility had bunks for approximately 1,596 inmates. Today I called the facility at 1115. Our count was 1,880, which is 284 inmates more than we were actually designed to handle. For you, Representative Williamson, when you were there and we walked through TRCI, you saw the inmates that are in our classrooms and our units. And we also have the temporary dorm that is in the back of our workforce area, where it's still temporary after 7 years. long before we knew the PREA standards, which we are now doing, and have come to our prisons, we have asked for staff in those areas. The safety of the inmates as well as officers are at risk there. In the dorm, you saw that the bunks are close together and that there are many blind spots. And most of the time, there's only one officer in that area. At this point, there are 88 inmates that live there. And because it was not designed for inmates to live in, the inmates must leave that area, travel through a work area, through a small break room area, and then on to the restrooms and the showers. Inmates travel through three separate doors, three separate rooms, and are in these areas alone, and we are not staffed sufficiently to be able to watch the inmates in those areas. I personally know that PREA is something Oregon has on its top of the list, and we are a forerunner in the nation on it, and I'm proud to say that we are. But if we're going to continue to be, we need better staffing in many of our institutions. We are trying to follow all of the PREA standards that the state has asked us to, but with the temporary bunks, inmates placed in designated areas that are not for inmates, it's impossible for us as staff to do this. I would ask that as you make your decision on the budget, that you remember these things. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming all this way to testify as well. And thank you for giving me a great tour when I was out there.
Thank you.
Matt, Darren, and Frank. And our next panel will have Jeff Kaufman, I think it's the last Ask Me person, Paul Solomon, and Jessica Katz.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I am Jeff Kaufman. I've been with EOCI, Department of Corrections, for 11 years. Working in correction facilities is a dangerous job. The housing units at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution have cell units having between 72 and 90 inmates on each unit. The dormitory units have between 82 and 107 inmates. In 2013 at EOCI, there were 218 fights with 478 inmates and people involved. Most of the fights have been between inmate gang members, but staff has also been assaulted and some can't return to their jobs. Most of the fighters have been treated by our on-site medical, but many have to be transported to hospitals for treatment. For example, in February 8th, 2014, inmate attempted to kill his cellmate. This was on an incentive house unit where they have to have 18 months clear conduct to live. The inmate dragged his victim out of the four-man cell they were living in, was quoted saying, "I've been trying to kill him, but he just won't die." March 10th, 2014, inmate was living on another incentive house unit. He placed a state-issued padlock in a sock and attacked another inmate. The next day, another regular cell house unit inmate was assaulted by a member, another inmate, and they had to be life-flighted to Cadillac Hospital in the Tri-Cities, and then he went to OHSU from there. This inmate will never be the same because of this attack. On April 4th, 2014, a warning shot had to be fired to break a fight in the West Recreational Yard. On August 29th of 2014, inmate was shot and killed in our West Recreational Yard due to a gang attack 2-on-1 where the victim was not able to defend himself. The Department of Corrections does not acknowledge gangs in our prison systems, but they are there and they're very dangerous. Our job requires us to provide a safe environment for inmates and our community also. Due to budget cuts, we have added approximately 200 more inmates to EOCI's population without adding any additional staff. We have also added more jobs for inmates, but also have been pulling security response staff to cover these work areas. We have six response staff on each side of the institution, the east side and the west side of the institution. When we have yards with over 210 inmates, we have four response staff in the yards to cover anything that might happen. On the east side of the institution, we pull one response staff to supervise the OCE call center. OCE does not reimburse the DOC for this cost.
that leaves one response staff to give breaks to all the unit officers on that side. And if that officer actually takes a break, walks out inside, they are the response. So it could take a minute to get back.
So your timer just went up. Yeah. So if you want to give a sentence or two to wrap up, that would be great.
Just one thing. In October 2014, PREA review, they recommended adding an additional security officer to monitor the UOCI physical staff. Last week, during a shakedown of the physical plant, they found an operational crossbow that was built by the inmates.
Wow. Thank you.
Co-Chair Williams, Shields, and committee members, it was interesting. I didn't know what to say today exactly, except that we needed money. It was very funny. I get to the front steps, and I was looking around, and I saw it was written for me. A free state is formed and maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and the sharing of benefits justly apportioned. Okay? We share the benefits, and we share the shortcomings. When we have cuts.
Oh, we need your name for the record.
Oh,
sorry.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
Matthew Ballard at CRCI.
Thank you.
And we share the gains and we share the losses. And a lot of times more people want to work on a new special project and they want to have something shiny and new and say, we reinvented the wheel and we're doing something special. Okay. All of the programs that have been passed in the past need to be maintained. We have a surveillance system. Half of it does not work. We have Measure 17 for inmate work crews, inmates working. We want them employed. Excellent bill written out. What we have? Shortfall in income. What happens? Management, they had to make cuts. They have to make cuts. They have to reapportion. They made things work in an impossible situation when we had to cut. They did a lot of work to save officers' jobs. And they brought them back when they could. Very much appreciated. They only did with what they were given, what they had. We have a lot of inmates that are not actively working. I have four janitors working on my unit where only one could do that very same job in half the time. Okay? We used to have five outside work crews. That actually helped in the Vernonia crisis. And these outside work crews can help in these statewide emergencies, and they can work on all these projects. It was unfunded. It was put into the other category. When it was in the general fund, they had enough money to support this. We had more inmates actually checking out and working an actual full day's work. Now they are given busy work, walking around in circles. Hello, this is your employment for 8 hours. I do not believe this is the purpose of Measure 17. And we have a lot of existing programs that work, that were sacrificed and cut to the bone because we had to cut to the bone to survive as a state. And we need to reestablish these working programs in the way that they were intended with a budget that will make them work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Frank Lewis. I have been in the department 24 years. I currently work at San Yam. I've spent about 12 and a half years at DOCI as well. And I want to talk to you a little bit about architecture of our institutions. Many of our institutions were other buildings before they were a prison. And even with the ones that were designed as prisons, we have blind spots all over them. At San Yam, for instance, we have one corridor with two rows of bunk beds in it, a TV room on one side, and then we have three other tiers going off of it with bunks in them. You can only see at most half of a unit at one time. We have inmates in rooms that should be offices, used to be offices. Several years ago, we had emergency beds added. Now, when they did that, they realized there's too many people in here. We need a second staff in here. We went up to 110 inmates on two of our units, and they put two staff on them. That went away. The staff went away. Everything's fine. Now we have those same emergency beds, except now it's 110 on every unit, and there's no additional staff. In our honor dorm, in order to create bunk space, they took two sets of bunk beds, slid them together. Well, we can't have inmates sleeping in the same bed. The answer to that was to put up a steel barricade between the bunks, which forms a virtual box, a cage, if you will, that you can't see into unless you're standing in front of it. Our recent pre-audit suggested strongly that these be removed. They didn't demand it because they could see that by doing this you can add extra bunks on the end. It's not safe for us, and it's definitely not safe for the inmates. We have a job here to do. We owe it to the people of Oregon. You know, we say that we are going to hold offenders accountable to prevent the risk of future criminal behavior. And we're proud of what we do. That's what we want to do. Part of that is protecting our inmates as well. We get paid to go in and risk our lives. We understand that. They've done something to put themselves in that place, but the state's already said what is going to happen to them. It's our job to keep them safe. And we have cameras in all of our institutions. Some of them even work fairly well. The problem is we can't sit and view that closed-circuit television unless we have a complaint from something that starts an investigation, or we have a confidential informant that comes up and says something happened. We don't have anybody to watch that monitor. There's not staff for it. It's in a control center. It would be like every one of you trying to watch television while you're trying to do your job. You can't do that effectively. You can do one or the other.
We try not to.
In short, we need more staff to do our jobs. We have the tools to do our job very well, but we just don't have the people to use those tools. It's not necessarily fiscally responsible to have those tools. With the programming that we've added, we have some great programs that do very good things. The family visiting, for one. But it takes additional staff. We've had to rob Peter to pay Paul in order to cover that. And it's at times we have one person doing four different jobs.
Yep. Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So Jeff, Paul, and Jessica. And on deck we'll have, I believe it's Nora, Sweet, Pat Fitterell. Oh, I think I said that wrong. But and Robin Rom. Paul, why don't you start?
Okay. Not sure where Jack is.
Jared Davis was the state
river was down right here. Are we missing one more? Or we're, no.
Does that
not
mean
Davis is not speaking.
Oh, done. Okay.
Does that mean I get an extra 3 minutes?
You get an extra 3 minutes. So if Nora, Pat, or Robin are in here, you can grab that seat. Go ahead, Paul.
Great. Thank you. Co-chairs, Representative Williamson, Senator Shields, members of the committee. My name is Paul Solomon. I'm the executive director at Sponsors Incorporated in Eugene, Oregon. I also serve on the Governor's Reentry Council and the vice chair of Lane County's Public Safety Coordinating Council. I'm here today to talk about the need to embrace evidence-based programs that are proven to reduce recidivism for people in custody and in the community. Given our limited funding for institutional and community-based programming, it is critical that we use our treatment dollars wisely. For the past 41 years, Sponsors has been providing reentry services in Lane County. We currently operate 12 buildings on 6 sites with 145 beds of transitional housing for people releasing from prison and jail, and are currently in development of a new 60-bed facility in partnership with Lane County's Housing Authority for people with criminal histories. We've been able to develop a range of programs based on years of experience and research. We provide a variety of on-site programs built around our transitional housing for men and women, including a mentoring program, cognitive behavioral therapy, a one-stop reentry resource center, a veterans program, an education program, drug and alcohol treatment, services for sex offenders, a legal clinic, and most recently a new facility for women and children that uses the Parenting Inside Out curriculum and provides services for children. Despite our growth, our programs have been oversubscribed. At this time, beds in our housing programs are regularly booked 6 to 8 months prior to release. Given the situation, it has become very important that we serve the right people. In recent years, we have embraced the use of validated risk assessment tools to determine who gets access to our programs and what type of services they receive. For this reason, we employ the risk needs responsivity model. Using validated risk assessment tools, in our case, the LSCMI, we are able to focus on the highest risk individuals. Practically speaking, we prioritize our resources to the highest risk. So, a couple points I want to make. As a nonprofit that receives community corrections grant and aid funding, as well as 3194 justice reinvestment funding, we're required to provide evidence-based services that are cost-effective and can be measured. And my point is, with limited funding for corrections programs, we need to ensure that our dollars are serving the maximum number of people to the greatest effect. We know that the vast majority of people in custody will return to our communities. I appreciate the task before you and your thoughtful approach, and sincerely hope that you will adequately fund DOC's effort to provide efficacious and cost-effective treatment strategies to those who have the greatest need and will return to our community. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't put a plug in for fully funding House Bill 3194's Justice Reinvestment Program at the level in the governor's budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica.
Good afternoon, Senator Shields, Representative Williamson, committee members. I don't know if this is on. I'm grateful for the opportunity to discuss with you today an issue that I feel should be of great importance to all Oregonians. Today in the United States, 2.8 million children have a parent in prison. An international human rights organization has recently cited parental incarceration as the greatest public health risk to children, and having an incarcerated parent is considered in the National ACEs Adverse Childhood Experiences Study as a risk factor serious enough to lead to disease and early death.
Actually, if you back away from the mic, it works better.
Okay. Yeah. Children who suffer the loss of a parent to death or divorce are said to experience less trauma than children who lose a parent to the criminal justice system. From 2003 to 2015, a program operating at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility aimed to address and reduce risk factors to the children of women incarcerated there. In the 12 years of serving families impacted by parental incarceration, we learned many lessons. We learned that the path that leads most women to prison includes a significant amount of trauma resulting from insecure childhood attachments, abuse, struggles with addiction. Unless women are given the opportunity to examine their trauma histories and the tools and support to heal from their past, they will continue to hurt and in turn hurt others, oftentimes their children. And most importantly, we learned that though people, you may separate people from society for a period of time, people don't live in isolation. They live in relation and within a context. They also one day return to society, and they either return to something or they return to nothing. It's our responsibility within the context of corrections to ensure that they return to something. There's a tremendous amount of collateral damage that occurs on one's path to prison and many unintended consequences. We're just beginning to truly understand the extent of the damage, and the question before us now is, how do we move the dial, and how do we address the great human financial costs that we incur? I believe the answer to this question is that until we eliminate incarceration, we have no choice but to offer a coordinated and holistic response within our prison system. And this requires taking the long view. It requires that the Department of Corrections is provided with the resources to extend its scope of work to include families. It requires a shift in thinking. Currently, the Oregon Department of Corrections has taken the position that programs that serve children and families are valuable, but not necessarily their responsibility. Their responsibility is to the adults in their custody, and while this may be true, it raises a very important question of, if not your responsibility, then whose? We have an unintended consequences to our over-reliance on the criminal justice system to solve larger social problems that has created a public health epidemic for children. We can either point the finger in another direction, hope for the best, or develop a smart and coordinated response, an antidote. Without a doubt, this response will cost money on the front end. This type of investment in a future that is not definitively known creates unease. It requires a leap of faith that if we address those conditions for children that are predictive of their continuing destructive intergenerational patterns, we will break the cycle. This theory has been tested on a small scale through the Family Preservation Project, and in 5 years, not one participant has returned to prison. I urge you today, as people in a position to shape the future of some of these 2.8 million children with a parent in prison, to not turn your back. I urge you to take the long view. It's not only a wise investment, but simply the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Hi. My name is Nova Sweet.
Sorry.
I don't know if you can hear me, but.
Yeah, we can hear you.
So I'm a third generation Oregonian. I graduated from a local high school, Corvallis High School. I played college basketball at the University of Louisville, where I got my undergrad degree and my first graduate degree in criminal justice. I went on to Portland State and got an MSW, and I learned a lot of great, amazing things. But what I learned the most was in the past 3 years when I got to live at the Department of Corrections. I just was released from the DOC last month and had the opportunity to be one of the Family Preservation Project participants. And what that program gave me was something I never learned in school or in athletics or in my family, and that was how to be a mom, how to be accountable for my decisions, how to actually have some values that I could stand on and that I wouldn't waver when the right guy came along or the right fun time or risky situation came along, because I think a little bit differently, so those things got me off track. The Family Preservation Project took me as is. Didn't tell me it was okay, but told me how to get okay with myself and help me work through that. And in doing that, I was able to raise my children from behind the fence, stay in touch with them twice a week by phone, visit with them twice a month in therapeutic visits, participate in their parent-teacher conferences throughout the school year, work on my own personal issues around addiction and codependency, and form relationships with other moms who are struggling just like me, because I used to be the oddball, which would be a reason why I would use to go into a group of other moms that I thought had it all together and I didn't know what I was doing. So I found out that other people sometimes think like that, and we were all sober, and I was able to figure out how to play with my daughter at 6 years old when she first started coming in there. And today she just turned 8, and I actually got to plan her birthday party, and I got to be at that birthday party in a room full of 18 other mothers, and I did fabulous, and I was sober doing it, and I give all the credit to the FPP program and how those women, not only the participants, but the teachers, the counselors, the instructors helped me become a whole person. I experienced self-efficacy. I'm not just talking about it. I actually experienced it on a whole level inside the Department of Corrections. And that was my choice to pursue that, because those options aren't just available for women to do that in there, because I wasn't considered somebody who was really at risk to come back to prison, but I was in prison. And so I made the most of it, and the Family Preservation Project helped me do that. And so I'm in full support of funding this program for Oregon to set the stage for the rest of the United States. Let's do something different. Let's show people that we really care about women and children. Let's make a change. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So Robin, Pat, and Ashley Doherty, I think. And then our next panel will be Karen Nibbler, Barbara Ross, and I think it's Craig Bassey.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having public testimony on the budget, and thank you for listening to us. My name is Robin Rahm, and I'm actually here as a taxpayer. I don't take any income from any of these programs. I started volunteering for the Family Preservation Project in the summer, last summer, just teaching a memoir workshop. And I had taught in prisons before in Rhode Island, and I'd never seen anything quite like the Family Preservation Project. The women in that group were substantially more self-confident, more introspective, and able to process and talk about their past in a way that was really beneficial to the memoir workshop, but also really beneficial to them personally. In the memoir workshop, I got to hear a lot of personal stories, a lot of stories about the collateral damage that incarceration causes in the lives of kids. We heard stories about kids, hiding under tables when they would see their moms in visiting, or leaning away in the visiting room, really not having the kind of attachment that you would hope that they would have with their mother. And then I got to see firsthand these same children that were represented in these stories with their mothers on the Saturday therapeutic visits. And the change is hard to describe, but here are two stories. One story that I heard in the memoir workshop was a mother whose 2-year-old daughter came in to the regular visiting room, and the parents had a bag of quarters somebody brought a bag of quarters for the vending machine, and the 2-year-old was so disoriented and confused that she took the bag of quarters, went to the correctional officer and said, "Here's some money, can my mom please come home?" And that kind of trauma on a 2-year-old is pretty profound. And that same 2-year-old I got to see as, a much older child with her mother, riding her mother, playing with her mother, riding her like a pony in the therapeutic visitation, reading, falling asleep in her mom's arms. And as just a person and a person with a mother, I can tell you that that has had a profound effect. I saw it. You can feel it. You can sense it when you're in the room. It's been said that the program is expensive, that it costs $300,000. You can argue that maybe it costs $200,000, maybe it costs $250,000. But the fact is that the numbers that Nancy Campbell Med didn't have but referred to is that it's $31,286 per year to keep a woman in prison. If any of the kids go to prison as a result of attachment problems, or of, you know, just not having access to a parent or all kinds of risk factors that go into being a kid with an incarcerated parent, it's $86,756 per year to keep a kid in the juvenile justice system. So if you keep three children out of the system through the Family Preservation Project, it pays for itself with taxpayer money. I mean, I'm a taxpayer. That's what I'm coming here as, and I really feel that my dollars are best spent preventing that kind of damage. And so I think that the program should be kept and expanded and made to serve more women, if anything. I also know there's been discussion to sort of take the Family Preservation Project away and make a new program that essentially does similar things. But my concern is also that seems like a lot of waste of a program that spent 10 to 12 years developing a strategy for dealing with all of the barriers that women confront in prison. Why reinvent the wheel when the wheel has been made and has been made pretty well? This program has a 0% recidivism rate. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. My name is Pat Vitellaro. In August of 2012, my daughter Melissa joined the FPP program. This opportunity changed my grandson's life. Sorry. Up to this point, Vinny's experiences with his mom were limited to the confines of a large visiting room filled with strangers. This program changed everything for Melissa and the strong bond she now shares with her son. It provided learning opportunities, educational support, and mentorship that any mother would benefit from, but especially impactful for the mothers of Coffee Creek. Because of this bond, my daughter and these moms are resolved to leave this program with focus and skills needed to build a positive life. With the support of this program, it's incredible, and its incredible staff, they leave more prepared to be successful mothers and contributing members of society. Lastly, this program has had a profound effect on my family and all the caregivers. We too were supported in our efforts to care for these children. I witnessed the change in my daughter and these moms to resolve to be the best moms that they could be. So this fills us with hope in knowing that this time was well spent for the moms and their children, for our families, and most importantly, our community. Research shows that incarcerated women who have regular enriching contact with their children are much more likely to succeed and stay out of the judicial system. This research supports my heartfelt belief that this program is crucially important for the success and well-being of all mothers at Coffee Creek. I urge you to continue this great work, to expand this program, to give all mothers the opportunity to participate and strengthen their bonds with their children and family. And for my family, it has made all the difference. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, my name is Ashley Doherty. And I stand for FPP as well. I was released several weeks ago from Coffee Creek, and I was lucky enough to be part of FPP for almost 3 years of my incarceration. I got into the program at a very detrimental state in my life. DHS was trying to terminate my parental rights, and I heard of this program, and I was lucky enough to get in. And, you know, with my situation, I was doing a significant amount of time. My daughter was at a very young age. They really were pushing for a termination of my rights. And with the help of this program, I was able to fight for myself. I was given, you know, phone calls to DHS and helped stay in contact with DHS. And, you know, the facilitators and, you know, really they're just mentors that, like, gave me the confidence to push for what I really believed in and being a mother. And so DHS agreed to a guardianship. So someday I will get to, you know, have her back in my care full time. And that's one thing that has just been, you know, I think about when I look at, like, I didn't know what I was going to say today, but, you know, someone said, just say what it's done for you. And that's so huge, because I think about, what if they had terminated my rights, and where would I have gone? Like, you know, this program has given me hope, period. To have that be an opportunity in my life, to have something to go home to. You know, these women that, you know, I had a lot of emotional damage. You know, I beat myself up, and, you know, they've helped me rebuild my self-worth, which is in turn making it so I can be a better person, so I could be a better mother, so I could be a better member of society and give her a good role model to be, you know, something that she can look up to, and not just, you know, oh, my mom went to prison and now I don't see my mom anymore. You know, my daughter has a big, huge support system. You know, FPP has the caregivers, you know, they get so much help, and it's like a support group for them as well. You know, being able to feel like I'm just the worthiness of being her mother. You know, I was able to contact her schools and have parent-teacher conferences from prison, and, you know, and I've met those teachers now, and that's so cool to be like, you know, you heard me on the phone, and now here I am, and I'm doing the right thing. And it's just, you know, the hope that this program has given me, you know, I'm able to take a step in the right direction and keep taking another step in the right direction. And, you know, I was just talking about how my daughter is as ornery as ever. You know what I mean? Like, we've been able to have these therapeutic visits and these special visits where I was able to not just play with her and eat junk food with her in a visiting room with strangers. You know what I mean? I was able to parent her when she was, you know, acting out. You know, I didn't feel ashamed because I was in a group of other mothers and people who were there to support me, to, you know, have her sit down and take a time out and just to do the things to be a parent in the correct way. So now I'm not parenting out of guilt, you know, so that we can have a healthy relationship. And, you know, this program is just so important. And the parenting programs, they do not even, you know, live up to what FPP does. And I know that was a little dinger, but there's just so much that this program is. And, you know, I know it's expensive, but there's so much value in this money and these lives, because it doesn't just touch the inmates. It touches so many more people. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Karen, Barbara, and Craig. And then on deck, we have Marcia Kelly. Ashley. We just had Ashley. And Christina Jenks. And that's all I have for folks signed up. So if there's anybody else who wants to speak, let us know. Otherwise,
maybe I'll start.
Go ahead.
Follow up on the pink shirts. I couldn't quite bring myself to put one on, but I'm here in support. I have blue and pink, I guess. But I'm here in support of the Family Support Program. My name's Craig Botsy. I'm the manager of the Dominguez Reentry Resource Center here in Salem, which is a local community-based reentry program. So I had remarks prepared, but I think everybody that preceded me spoke to those things. So I'll just be brief and mention that as a program that kind of picks up with folks on the other side of the gate, knowing that family or any kind of support system is so huge in being successful, that we want to lend, you know, our support to the Family Preservation Program as a way of building that support and then maintaining it post release. So that's essentially my remarks.
Sorry. It's trying to make the person go away. Thank you.
Anyway,
thank you.
Thank you.
Now put Barbara on the spot.
Yeah. let me see if I can get my phone to go.
Better. I just want to get all the attention I possibly can. My name is Barbara Ross, and co-chair Williams and Fields, and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Ross, and I live in Portland. And I just want to take a few minutes to talk to you about the importance of the Justice Reinvestment Program. It is working really well in Multnomah County. We are thrilled with how well it's working. And the reason it's working is that they got all the partners together, the DA staff, the defense attorneys, probation, parole, community corrections, their service providers. They're all on the same page and have all committed to working on this. They just sort the offenders out. The ones that are bad guys, they send them off to prison. They don't even consider the Major 11. But anyway, they look at the rest, they're eligible, and they send the bad ones off to prison. The ones that are good, just screwed up, they take those and put them on regular parole They give them a rule book and say, if you abide by the rules, we're going to let you out early. And again, that's a money-saving thing. The rest, they really look at carefully and say, what do these people need to avoid committing new crimes? What can we do for them to stabilize their lives, to give them hope, to give them the structure that they need? And so they do this assessment, and then they all get together. If they agree, they have a conference in front of the judge. If they agree on the plan, then the person enters a period of 120 days of intensive supervision, and they have to go by what the plan says. And they have about 7 services, and again, the magic is they only do the services that that person needs: housing, peer mentoring, drug and alcohol treatment, mental health services, employment assistance, education, or just job search skills. Whatever that person needs, they give them what they need, and then they enter this 120 days of intensive supervision where they have to abide by what their plan says, and they check in with their parole officer at least once a week. And there's enough structure there, and they're given encouragement if they do the right thing. If they do the wrong thing, they're given an immediate, small, appropriate sanction. So they get an immediate response if they screw up and drink a beer in the park. That's, you know, they're not going to send into prison for 10 years for drinking a beer, but they're going to say, you know, you've got some consequences. And so in Multnomah County, they are showing remarkable results because everybody's working together, and they paid attention to all the details of the process. Who does what? Which piece of paper has to go where, when? What happens at the conference? What does the DA say? They pay attention to all the little details, and the results are actually absolutely amazing. The first year, they are going to save $8.6 million. $8.6 million. That's 243 offenders who would have gone to prison who are not going to prison. That's $96 a day. That's 365 days. And that adds up to $8.6 million. That doesn't count the ones who get out of prison early or other money-saving programs. So I think if all the counties did as well as Multnomah County, we'd be doing really well, and we could save enough money to keep our prison population flatlined and avoid spending all this money on $300 million on a new prison. The state can't afford that. We don't need to. And because the structure of this program is strong enough to keep these offenders in line, we can keep the community safe, we can avoid new crimes, and we can save a bunch of money. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Karen.
Karen Nibbler. I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And we supported 3194 last session. I've been really interested in how the implementation has gone in the last couple of years, and the buy-in from different counties. And it's probably different levels of buy-in, but the more I hear, it seems like more of the people are seeing the benefit of it. But the main stumbling block is probably going to be funding. You know, a particular county is going to want a certain amount of funding in order to set up these programs, and they're going to want to think it's consistent too. So we would encourage you to fund as much as possible these programs, and it has to be up front before they can save the savings for not putting people in prison. So that's the first point. The other thing, I was disappointed in 3194 that it didn't go far enough to consider some of the juveniles who were sentenced in the adult system. And the good thing is that when they are sentenced to DOC, that they can remain at the Oregon Youth Authority facilities, which is to their benefit. And some of these kids have done pretty well, have gone through educational programs, and some of them even have gotten college degrees. But then they face that time when they're going to be transferred into a DOC facility because they've aged out. And I think somehow we should have some mechanism that takes a look at those kids at that point and decides whether they should go on to a DOC facility or whether they should have some method of early release or supervision in the community or something, rather than sending them on to a DOC facility when they've done well. So if there's any possible way to do that, in the future. I think that would be useful, and it would also be a good example to the other kids. The other thing that we've been concerned about is the availability of educational and treatment programs within the prison facilities. And we recognize that when the budget gets tight, that's one of the things that they can cut. And they have to have the staff to supervise. So that's maybe an easy cut. However, it makes such a difference because 95% of these people are coming back to the community. So if they can get some education while they're in there, or work experience, or counseling and drug and alcohol treatment while they're in there, they're going to come out in better shape. So I would encourage you as much as possible to fund some of the programs that are within the prison. And I did have the opportunity to go visit Coffee Creek. And what I talked to them about was they wanted to hear about lobbying. How do you go lobby the legislature? But what I talked about was 3194, and that they were going to have this option when they got out, you know, maybe first working on some things that, and that the parole and probation officers wanted to keep them from going back to prison. So that was a big thing. But what they told me, and they wanted me.
Last thought. Your buzzer went off. Okay.
What they wanted me to say to you was, you know, they needed these educational and counseling programs, and they wanted them because they had all this time, and they're a captive audience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so Marcia and Christina, the last two I have on the list, you'll bring it home. Because I know other folks are going to meetings since we're running a little over, but I want to make sure we can hear from everybody.
Marcia Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition lobbyist, and I'm here probably to reiterate a little bit of the same information that your taxpayer said. Only five people coming back to prison would pay for the program. Just the cost of their incarceration would pay for the program for 2 years. And this program has a zero recidivism rate. That's not counting the cost for foster care for the kids or other costs to the schools, to the community system. The family preservation program would be a good model to make sure it exists. It's evaluated very well and then spread out to the rest of the world and to the rest of Oregon. It really is remarkable what they've been able to do with the limited amount of money that they have. Our prisons are not necessarily places where you get good counseling. We should make sure that that happens more. And to cut a very small program in a very large budget that has such good rate of return is, to me, not a very cost-effective way of preserving the state of Oregon and what we want to have for the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
My name is Christina Jenks, and I'm here in support of FPP. I am also here for a voice as a, I was an incarcerated mother. I just was released from prison, not this last Wednesday, but the Wednesday before. So I've been out for 1 week and 1 day. And some of the challenges that I faced in there were not only not having consistent contact with my youngest son, but also not having proper legal representation and not having access to a phone where I could call the courts because you have to push buttons to get through to the court clerk. And so I heard of the FPP program, and I was on the waiting list, and I got accepted into that program, but my son's father wasn't willing to bring my son, and so I was put into the FRC program where I could mail out cards weekly to all my children. They were very instrumental in me being consistent in staying in contact with my children that way. And also, I was filing modifications so that I could have parenting time back with my children, and I did that on my own. And luckily, I worked in the law library, and so I had little bit more access, not more access, but I was there more to learn my rights. So I really had more time to read up and advocate for myself and type up those motions and file them with the courts. And I believe that if I hadn't had the access through FRC and it, to be able to call the courts, I don't know if the judge would have been able or would have not been able to, but would have signed those, because I was able to be consistent and call the court clerk and talk to the judge assistant and find out what was going on with my case. And so they were very instrumental in me being able to stay in contact with the courts. And I know the barriers that other women had faced coming through the law library and that I assisted was, I think they lost hope, because there's not a lot of resources as far as attorney contacts or being able to have access to attorneys. I know I myself mailed out over 50 letters asking for assistance from attorneys, and I got two letters back. And I'm like, I could maybe afford one of them. So I believe that funding for FPP is very vital, because it's not just for the inmates, it's for the children too and the families. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you all for coming to the hearing and staying late. With that, I'm going to close our public hearing. Ms. Gilbert, is there anything you'd like
Monday,
to say?
Monday, you are on a field trip.
Excellent.
To Coffee Creek.
Excellent. Yeah. All right. With that, I will close the committee. Thank you. With that, I will close the committee. Thank you.